when I think about writing, besides my grandfather's, I think about my uncle, who, it seemed every time we saw him, had something funny to do. And if I were to report it, it wouldn't sound funny at all, but I remember times when I would sit on Sunday afternoons at my grandfather's house just laughing my head off because my uncle was out on a little motor scooter with my aunt's wig on, riding up and down, you know, doing Indian things, or what he would laugh at his Indian things. So I think humor has always been a part of my family. It's always been a part of the storytelling. It's always been a part of how I was taught to look at the world.
Mm-hmm. That brings up the topic of storytelling. That's an important theme in your work.
Absolutely.
I remember the part about your excuse for joining ROTC, which you embellished to the extent of lies.
Well,
but then you
true
come
lies.
Back. And then also your storytelling to amuse your sisters and their friends, which is, you have no story in mind, but you keep going on until you get them to laugh.
The latter is an autobiographical fact. First novels oftentimes have a lot of autobiography in them, and while I don't lay claims to any of that in Angels, I will say that my sisters used to have a great deal of fun saying, "Come on in here, little Billy," and I'd come in and they'd say, tell us that joke. And I'd say, "What joke?" And they'd say, "The joke about a man and a dog." And I'd just start, "Well, once upon a time," which is the way all my stories start, "there was a man, and of course he had a dog." And then I would start telling these stories, and they would be rolling on the floor. What I didn't realize at the age of 5, 6, and 7 was they were rolling on the floor because the story was not funny, it was not interesting, it was one of the worst things they'd ever heard. But I didn't know that. So between that, I had a lot of practice. Now, when Allie tells a story about ROTC, that's really his creating a story, but the story is a lie, and he's creating the story to excuse his misbehavior. And I think probably as far as storytelling goes, that is another kind of story which people use, I think. And I like, I'm glad you noted it, but I like that section because I think Allie goes to extremes to create this elaborate excuse as to why he's doing what he's doing or has done what he's done.
And because he wants to belong.
And because really what he ought to do is just go apologize like a human being. I mean, like a mature human being. I say, "Look, I'm sorry, that was wrong to do." But he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And storytelling is and remains real important to me. The novel I'll read from tonight involves a Nez Perce mother who is actually attempting to dream, and by dreaming a kind of Nez Perce religious practice, she's trying to arrange it so her son can bring into existence by giving it words his own true love. And again, this is it's a much more complicated version of storytelling, but it still remains important to me and always will.
Your grandfather in the novel is essential, and he combines everything, the humor. He's essential for the humor. He's essential for the spirituality of it, the connectedness between you and your heritage. But he's not always wise. He often doesn't make any sense at all. And I love his saying, "It often happens like that."
It's true. I think if my grandfather, I know it sounds strange, still do talk to him, and I can hear him right now saying, "Oh, thanks a whole lot." I'm glad you find him not always wise. When I reread Angels, I find him a little bit, not wooden Indian-ish, but as though I've just dumped too much in his lap. I've depended on him for sort of to tether Allie to everything that I think of as real humor, the storytelling and all that kind of thing. But what was the last part of that statement? You can edit this part out. What was the last thing you said about him?
Well,
you said,
his tendency when you go to your grandfather to say something that has gone not quite right, then he'll say, well, it often happens like that, or some paraphrase.
He was that way because I think originally the novel started, it happens if it happens at all this way. And it was going to be told, but yeah, his grandfather does say it happens.
Uh-huh.
It happens. My grandfather was the grandfather I was thinking a lot of, and I think more people than I have had trouble trying to get a hold of their grandfathers, mm-hmm. because they're such mythic and sometimes unreal, mm-hmm. figures. Mm-hmm. I actually think he's much more real in Sins than he is in mm-hmm. Angels, as mm-hmm. far as if we're thinking of the grandfathers mm-hmm. being the same person mm-hmm. or based on the same person.
Well, yes, yeah, so I read the novel first, and then I read All My Sins Are Relatives, and recognized the characters, of course, as they came up, and I recognized the ideas that were very articulately expressed in Sins.
Thank
and
you.
Very artistically, I guess, expressed in the novel. What is the region you call the absence of angels?
I was thinking of that area in which communication can occur between real and unreal people.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to diagram it, it would be, you know, a satellite.
Yes.
It would be a telecommunication satellite. But
I like your communication with your grandfather, and you would get busy signals, and it's...
Grandfathers have a lot to do.
But you know, I believed it.
Good.
And now you're verifying that I think this man does.
My 10-year-old daughter has never met my grandfather, but he is very real to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks to him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this isn't some kind of strange hug-a-tree syndrome. He's very real because my stories about him to her have made mm-hmm. him very real, which I'm grateful for. And I would say, you know, back then I would have said she's communicating mm-hmm. with him in a place that is not imbued with Christian mythology, angels, not imbued with anything other than it's open, it's empty in a sense, but it's very, very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And so communication can occur, I guess, is the way I would say it.
You mentioned that you're working on three novels.
Three books.
I try
to keep them
novels?
Separate. Yeah. Besides the three I have coming out, mm-hmm. I'm working on a new novel, which, what is my working title? I can't even remember. I know it's on my computer. It's titled A Novel in Five Essays. Now this... is obviously what's happened to me is All My Sins Are Relatives were supposedly essays, but there was a lot of sort of imagining things going on in it. And Absence of Angels is fiction, but there was a lot of reality in it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've started to think that there's real blurring between the two genres. So this novel in five essays is really something. It's not me. It's not people, but it is, although I have a 10-year-old daughter, it is a novel told primarily from about a 35-year-old young woman's point of view, and in part she's 10 years old. So I'm working on that one. I think it's originally titled it Smiley's Girls, and I won't tell you how I got that title. And then I have this whole thing about Justina, the death of Justina, and that sort of thing. But for now, I'm not worrying about the title.
Mm-hmm.
I've got about 120 pages of that. And I'm sort of having fun doing it. It takes up ideas, ostensibly, things like daycare, ideas like tradition. But you wouldn't recognize any real expositional discussion of daycare or expositional discussion of tradition. And I don't want to give too much away for fear that I'll throw it all out anyway.
No.
Much earlier in the process is a book which is, as I said, comedy and cultural survival, which I'm really starting to read for now. I'm designing, it started with me just being interested in the topic, and I'm designing an integrative arts and humanities course titled that, and it suddenly dawned on me that if I'm that interested in it to design a course, why not take a real look at what comedy and what cultural survival, what those two things mean, and not limit it simply to Native America or to Latino Chicano writing, but also go back to the lost poetics of Aristotle, or the lost parts on comedy in the poetics of Aristotle, and deal with Njal's saga, Icelandic sagas, deal with some things which I think are, in a sense, comic, but most people ignore, maybe bring in some Ionesco and that sort of thing. So I'm really playing with it at this stage, trying to decide what it is. But it will be a book of essays, almost inevitably. Whether or not somebody will want to publish it is another another matter. And then I am editing. Actually, I'm planning on co-editing, but I'm editing a historical anthology of Native American drama. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not an expert in drama, but I hope I am by the time this is done. So, and this is contracted by a press, so it almost inevitably will be published.
I look forward to seeing that.
I think it might be useful. It's never been done. There are no historical anthologies of Native American drama. Nobody knows what was done in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century in any kind of coherent way. Mm-hmm. And Diane Glancy and Hane Geigema, and I mean, people who are real important, real good people, do anthologies, but it's always of Native plays since, almost since Smoke Signals, but I will say since 1970. So I'm kind of excited about it. I mean, we're going to put in Will Rogers' radio scripts, some of those. And, of course, the editor who commissioned this said, well, we want only Native people. And I said, I gather you don't know that William Benadire Rogers was Cherokee, right? And, you know, these sorts of things are going on. But also Lynn Riggs, who wrote, I can't remember the title of his play, but it's almost verbatim what we now know as Oklahoma.
Really?
With musical. So all of those things were Native American in origin, actual origin, not just some sort of obscure tangential.
Well, that's origin. It's an important book to be written.
I think it might be
because
fun.
I've had I don't know how many courses in drama, and this is new ground.
That's what I like to do. Mm-hmm. It's not new ground, it's new ground for me, and
for
it's
me.
It's
yes.
It's new ground for you. And when I do things like this, I like to do things that simply haven't been done, and by means of which I learn a lot. On the other hand, it makes me something of a dilettante, doesn't it?
Well, you are forgiven when you're a writer.
I suppose.
Sure.
Yeah.
Who do you read when you're not busy writing?
Oh boy. I'm almost as dilettantish in my reading as I am in what I work on. Lately, I think because university life has the propensity to become serious, I've tried to read mostly comic things. And having just been to London with a group of students last summer, one of the funniest books I read was Bill Bryson's Notes from a Small Island, which is about English culture and is very... I mean, it's you talk about laugh out loud, it's laugh out loud. I'm about to leave for New York tomorrow morning, and I'm taking Lucy Tapahanzo, who's a Southwestern poet, with me, so I suppose she would be included. But I will read almost anything that grabs my eye at any time. I love books. I love good stories. I like a lot of Native American fiction. And poetry, and I like a lot of non-Native fiction and poetry. I just don't limit myself. So that doesn't answer it. I mean, I could make a list. Alfredo Vea is a Chicano writer I like very much. A lot of the Native writers, I mentioned Diane Glancy, Louis Owens, these people are friends of mine anyway, but yeah, I read them. And I love people like the Russians, and I love Virginia Woolf, and I love Conrad, and I love...
Well, now that you start mentioning these names, of course, they're reminding me of what you have written in Angels. You were talking about Virginia Woolf there and
do I?
Others. Yes, you do.
I don't remember.
Yes, you
but
do.
Yeah,
and
good.
Robert Elliott lots of people.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I want to give you some opportunity to get ready for your reading, and
okay.
I thank you again very
thank
much
you.
For talking to us
thank
this
you.
Evening.
Thank you.